Welcome to episode 6 of Junk Filter, a new podcast about film, music, politics, and jokes. My name is Jesse Hawken, and my guest today is Daniel Reynolds, a Toronto-based writer and online person. He's the editor-in-chief for Raptors HQ and a critic for Brief Take. He also works as a traffic planner for the City of Toronto. Daniel insisted on coming on the pod with me to talk about the ridiculous fight in Toronto over the closure of a barbecue restaurant that was resisting public health demands as the city continues to fight the COVID-19 pandemic. And we want to tie this dystopic atmosphere of civic paranoia and assimilation to an evergreen science fiction concept, the invasion of the body snatchers. Daniel Reynolds, welcome to Junk Filter.
Thanks for having me, Jesse.
We had a funny meeting because we knew each other on Twitter.com, but you came up and introduced yourself to me when I was introducing a screening of Ishtar at Bell Lightbox.
That's right. I feel like there's always this weird sort of moment where you meet someone that you know online. This has happened quite a bit, I think, for me, and it's always kind of like, yeah, I know you. We know each other, but you don't really. It's kind of a funny moment, and then you sort of now you're in real life together. It's kind of a funny thing. And Ishtar was great. You were right.
Oh, thank you so much. I was so happy to see a room full of people enjoying Ishtar, which probably only happened a couple of times in the history of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Matthew! Matthew! Matthew!
Like the others.
Elizabeth, wake up. Get you when you sleep. Sit up.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
It's got no detail, no character. It's unformed.
All of a sudden, they're growing like parasites. Is it contagious?
People are being duplicated.
How do you know my name? I didn't tell you my name.
I can't find anything in here that looks like a body.
I saw its nosebleed.
It looked right at me.
You're looking at it as if it was human. It was not human.
We're going to talk mostly about BBQAnon, as I would love everyone to call it. We're going to talk about this barbecue revolution that's going on in Toronto. But I do want to tie it up to the themes of the science fiction classic Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It's a film that's been made 4 times since the 50s. It's based on a Jack Finney story. It has generally always served as a metaphor for the times in which they were made. How many of the Body Snatchers movies have you seen, Daniel?
So I've seen 2. I've seen the original from, what was it, 56, I think, or 55, and then the 78 classic, which really, which I will admit I only saw for the first time just recently, although it was one of those movies that was on my list as something I should eventually definitely see, and it definitely delivers. And I know what you're thinking of. The next one is the Abel Ferreira one, and then Invasion, which I don't know anyone who saw that movie.
I've actually seen all 4.
Oh, wow.
Of course, I saw the 1978 version first, and I had a 70s childhood. The movie was rated PG, if you can believe that.
What?
Yeah. So my parents were like, okay, let's go see Invasion of the Body Snatchers. But I guess they didn't exactly know just how grim the movie was. And I mean, I loved it as a kid, but I also was terrified of it, especially the ending, the infamous ending, which, you know, I guess we shouldn't spoil too much. I mean, spoiler alert, the invaders generally win in these movies. But I just want to briefly talk about the series as it evolved. The original by Don Siegel was an interesting 50s science fiction movie that served up a secret critique of 2 dynamics in American history, which you could read either way based on your political views. Some thought that it was a film about communism and the Red Scare. So right-wing audiences sort of thought of that as the metaphor, whereas more left audiences read it as a critique of the McCarthy era and the conformity of the Eisenhower era, the idea of this booming middle class being forced into conformity and proper behavior and singling out people who aren't. The original film was remade in 1978, and I think it's my favorite, by Philip Kaufman. He moves the invasion to San Francisco. And so now, instead of a small town being overrun by mysterious body snatchers, it takes place in a metropolis where even the mechanics of running a big city help to create the assimilation we see, you know, strangers in the street who seem to know each other. And we watch as people start suspecting whether or not their husband or their wife has been taken over. And Donald Sutherland plays a public health inspector, which is just too funny when it comes to the metaphor of the whole barbecue revolution. Donald Sutherland's character works for the public health department for San Francisco. In the first 10 minutes of the movie, he shuts a restaurant down on a health violation.
Very fitting to the times we're in, I think. And I think that's sort of one of the reasons why we decided to talk about this movie. And I think what's also interesting is, you're right, there is a sort of malleability to the concept. And when you tie it into that original one, I think the biggest difference, again, not to spoil the endings of these old 40, 50, 60-year-old movies, the original one ends on a note where, like, almost not an upbeat note, but a note of like, oh, okay, whether you're right wing or left wing, whatever you believe the metaphor is, there's this idea at the end where, okay, now the forces that keep our society going, whether they're the military, the FBI, something, it's a sort of alluded to at the end that things will be set right, that they've still got enough time to correct or contain the spread of what's going on. Whereas in the 1978 version, again, I don't want to spoil it, that's not quite the case. And it's interesting that it sort of captures this, the society, our society, modern society, that's like built on institutions that may or may not be ready to fail at a moment's notice. And that's sort of what happens in the film and, you know, maybe where we are right now.
Philip Kaufman was part of the whole 70s, Easy Riders and Raging Bulls scene. He was kind of an adjacent to Spielberg and De Palma and Lucas. He was a Marin County filmmaker and was good friends with Lucas. And it was interesting that he decided to sort of make a foray into science fiction around the same time as Close Encounters and Star Wars. This film came towards the end of that first wave of science fiction. But it feels like a 70s paranoia movie, like The Conversation or The Parallax View. Mm-hmm. Which, oh, and The Conversation, by the way, is also set in San Francisco. It's a very different concept than the sort of small town paranoia of the original. There is a recurring theme in the film where you see just men in like good suits running like crazy down the street, terrified.
Mm-hmm. The editing choices, you know, in those early scenes where like a scene will start and like someone's running towards the camera or they sort of interrupt. It seems to interrupt or cut between something that is sort of abrupt or scary, but you're not really sure why there's this sense of unease. Like, you know why there's a sense of unease, but it's like the way Kaufman builds up the tension of that is really remarkable. And as you said, it does sort of fit into that 70s paranoia sort of film of the time.
And the whole idea that like this San Francisco, this city with such, you know, progressive attitudes and progressive politics, progressive approaches to therapy, yeah, and a multicultural city, and not even a city like that could withstand this takeover. Some people have also read this sort of metaphor that the film kind of predicted the changing of the sort of flower power generation into the sort of Reagan conservatism that sort of took over in California in the 80s, that this film could be looked at retrospectively as a portent of like how, you know, the hippies were going to turn into yuppies.
I mean, there is a sense in the film of like, not giving up per se, but the idea that like, well, it'll be just easier if you go along with this, if you play a part in the, you know, the society that the pod people are building, so to speak. And as the pressure of the film builds and as the heroes of the film, like, you know, start to see, get the sense of the scale of how overwhelming the situation is for them and how small they are in it. There is this sense of like, why are you fighting this? Like, why don't you just join in the new society? And I think you hit on something there that's kind of interesting in sort of two ways, in that when you put it in a big city context, there's this idea of you're trying to remake the city and get rid of all of the sort of spiky, prickly human emotions that make a city interesting. And some of those are, you know, whatever they may be, but they're part of what makes a city a city. And then it sort of speaks to this idea of like, why fight against what seems inevitable. Why even bother trying to, you know, work towards something better or different or more complete if you can just give in and join the evil empire, so to speak, the 80s, or like I said, how we are today.
What I find actually quite touching about Body Snatchers is the way that Kaufman illustrates humanity, especially the relationship between Donald Sutherland and Brooke Adams in the film. I mean, you know that they really like each other, but they're not together. She's married to another man who, of course, is now a pod person, which could conceivably bring this couple closer together. But they have these very lovely scenes of just the things that make humans so special, like friendship, and a friendship between a man and a woman, and just a kindred spirit. And you realize, you know, that's the sort of thing that gets wiped out in this kind of assimilation. Like, it's not just the fact of being human is being wiped out. It's the humanity that's also being wiped out.
Yeah, there's something to that. I think it's interesting that the script sort of works that idea in there in terms of, like, they're not together. And I think that, as you said, and I think that's, like, many times in these movies, the whole point of the two leads is that they eventually are going to end up together. But the way it sets off is like, no, they're just friends. They're you know, adjacent to each other. They're each other's shoulders, so to speak. And you're right. It's like one of those things, like just innocent flirting. Can't do it if you're a pod person. You know what I mean? You can't, you know, like, never mind. Like, forget it. So that's kind of a, you know, trying to capture the full sort of experience and emotion of being human. And I think, you know, when you meet some of the other characters, the Jeff Goldblum character and Leonard Nimoy's character, and like all the different, you know, the good and bad and the different sort of components of being alive and relating to other people, that, you know, it's a challenge, but that's part and parcel with existing.
One of the spooky coincidences is that The Body Snatchers was released in very, very late December of 1978. But a month earlier was the Jonestown Massacre, in which about 900 people took their own lives under the direction of the cult leader Jim Jones. Many of the people from the Jonestown Massacre were from San Francisco. They were people who came to San Francisco, like so many, looking for a better world, and found themselves in this cult. And it's very spooky that the Body Snatchers sort of is set in San Francisco, which is, and the sort of the pod culture in the movie is very cult-like. I don't know whether this was anything that was really noticed at the time, but it's something that I think about when I think about this movie.
I mean, I think that's another sort of element of it that's very unsettling, in that, like, there's no, I mean, there is hysteria in the film, in the sense that they're as the pod people start to get more and more pronounced and sort of brazen with how they're carrying out their operations. Obviously, they care less about maintaining a certain level of cover. But I think those early scenes, like the first half of the film, where you're building up this slow tension, and of course every sort of cut to a different person of authority or a different, there's all kinds of little touches when they go to the dry cleaner and the guy is saying that the owner is saying his wife is not his wife, or when she bumps into someone in the hallway and he looks back for a beat or two longer, like there's all these ominous buildings up of things. And it's funny that you sort of mentioned cult-like, because obviously, yeah, it's this idea of like almost like a secret society that's building up to get to something. But of course, you know, what it's getting to is not anything, you know, you want to be a part of ultimately.
And the pod people also seem to be running the mechanics of the city. Like, they're using the garbage trucks to deliver, you know, to collect all the leftovers from when the pods take over the humans. And towards the end, we see, you know, ships full of new pod supplies that are being sent internationally. It's just
that scene with the ship.
So chilling.
That scene with the ship is really remarkable, because there's a moment there, and this is where I think it really differs from the 50s version, where the 50s version, because it's set in a small town, it feels contained. It feels like there's that, you know, you're in a small space, and there's not, and you know, there's like one highway sort of thing, and it's like that's the main connection to the world. And this one, the scale is purposefully made larger. You're made to see the city at a larger scale. When that sequence later on with the ship, And you're like, oh, of course, the boats, right? San Francisco, they must be coming in from somewhere else. Everything's fine. We're going to be good. They're going to be saved. And then it's like, nope, it's already too late. The institutions have already, you know, you said the mechanisms of the city, the garbage, the shipping lines, the manufacturing, it's like it's already been turned over just like that. You know, it feels like in a night, basically.
Yeah, and our protagonists who are, you know, probably the last people left towards the end of the movie, they're completely outnumbered and outmanned, and it's just a matter of time.
Yeah, and the mechanics of that, I mean, that's why I'm amazed that it was PG. I know that the rating system is sometimes sort of all over the place. Some movies get you know, rated because there's, you know, one swear word or one scene of nudity or something. But in this one, it's like there's some pretty unsettling images in terms of duplicates and sort of some grossness and some body horror there. And obviously, you know, you're right. The desperation that grows in the two leads and sort of their relationship and how that, I mean, how that sort of comes apart is pretty heavy stuff. It's pretty grim.
No, it has not lost its power.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's a 40-year-old movie or so, but you know, it's just such a great movie. I think it's the ultimate version of this story. It also has some very funny little in-jokes referencing the original, because the first one ends with Kevin McCarthy on the highway warning everybody that the pod people are coming. And then he returns in the remake doing the same thing, except as an old man with a very definitive bad ending that comes to him. And also there's a cab driver towards the end of the movie who turns in our heroes, and he's Don Siegel.
You know, that's funny, because I actually only connected the dots like this week, like earlier this week, just being like, wait a minute, you know, wait, hold on a second. And then looking into that and going, wait a minute, they're in the same movie. I don't know. That's pretty wild. I love the idea that Don Siegel is just like around and like, oh yeah, sure. I'll pop in. I'll do a cameo in your movie. Like, okay.
There was a funny story in the commentary track where Kaufman said that they were filming the scene with Kevin McCarthy in the Tenderloin in San Francisco. And one of the people on the street said about Kevin McCarthy, he said, hey, that's the guy from the first movie.
What I love is I read an interview where Kaufman was basically saying like he liked the idea of that, like basically he just kept running. Like 20 years later, he's been running around warning people, and like this is what's happened. No one listened to him for 20 years, and so now he ends up here. And I think that's funny. And the other thing that's interesting when you're talking about cameos is that Robert Duvall is in like the opening like 5 minutes.
Yeah, he's the first pod person we see.
Yeah, like what, you know, as a priest, like what, you know, you're like, what the heck? Just like out of nowhere. Again, you're like, wait, Robert Duvall's in this movie? Yeah, sure, why not?
I don't believe he's credited officially, but yeah, he shows up at the very beginning and he's the first pod person on the swing.
Upsetting.
It's just such a great film, and it stands with the best of the great 70s paranoia movies, which were mostly made by Alan J. Pakula. Or Pakula?
That's actually
one of the two.
It definitely does, and it is kind of striking to consider. I mean, it's funny that you mentioned like Spielberg and Lucas and stuff, and it's interesting that Kaufman is obviously not mentioned necessarily or no as well known. Like his films are grand and they have a certain, like, I mean, this one, I mean, the score is incredible, the editing and production design are amazing, and it's fascinating that like, not, again, not that no one knows this movie. It's not like it's some hidden gem, but it's like interesting that like his legacy kind of like it just kind of, I don't want to say petered out, but like he's not said in the same breath as his contemporaries of the time necessarily. And it's interesting to me because these films are obviously like widescreen, you know, like considerable works.
Yeah, he peaked, I guess, in the late 80s when he did The Right Stuff. But mm-hmm. Then he did The Unbearable Lightness of Being, which was a huge art house hit. And he made Henry in June, which was the first NC-17 movie.
Really?
They introduced that new rating with that film.
Oh.
Because it wasn't pornography, but it was more than rated R. So they had to come up with a new rating system where they could make sure that there were no children in the theater. Because restricted movies in the States, an adult can bring a child to. Kaufman was always interested in sort of exploring, you know, more adult material, mm-hmm. which Body Snatcher certainly indicates. But no, he was making classy, sexy, classy movies like Unbearable Lightness of Being. But yeah, and then Kaufman did Rising Sun, which I actually slightly enjoy. Nobody likes Rising Sun, but I kind of did. with Sean Connery and Wesley
Snipes. Did he do that? Oh, really? Oh, no kidding. All right. Yeah, you know what? Actually, I haven't seen that one.
It's very strange. It's got lots of strange elements, and Snipes is really good in it.
I believe that. I went on a bit of a Connery tear. I mean, sort of, I guess it sort of coincided with his death, and some of those later period movies, I'm like, yeah, I should probably, I mean, I, you know, get in on that. But anyway, Rising Sun, I'll mark it down on the list.
Yeah, put it on your list. Yeah, it's very bizarre.
I can believe it.
When it's good, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
The Invasion of the Body Snatchers movies, you know, we'll probably get more of them, I'm sure. But in Toronto these days, it sort of feels like there's some kind of paranoid weirdness in the air. It has to do with the pandemic. It has to do in particular with, you know, what the right-wing press would like us to all refer to as the barbecue revolution. And Daniel, one of the reasons why I've had you on the show is because you really wanted to dig into this topic. I think you dig the metaphor for the Body Snatchers movies in this. You can see where I'm coming from.
Well, as you know, as you noted, this is a public health sort of fiasco now to a certain extent, and we're talking about a movie about something that starts as a public health sort of curio and then grows into a fiasco. And I think in our city, obviously we are sort of dealing with a situation that has how to put this? It got better. And it tested basically the limits of imagination of people. And then it got worse because they, you know, the people in power can't sort of figure out a way to address this properly. And now the desperation, let's say, of the average person is growing. And you know, you mentioned the right-wing press. It's been fascinating and sort of sad and terrifying and every other negative term you can think of to watch them sort of fight it out, like, I don't want to say with themselves, but like with like this kind of weird schism in their brain. So like to watch, you know, this barbecue, Adamson barbecue fiasco going down where one restaurateur decides to break the lockdown as if he's some great, valiant truth teller, and then realize that, you know, the right wing sort of are bolstering his message, but they're also sort of supporting their dear leader, Doug Ford, the provincial leader. And it's this kind of weird thing where they're trying to play both sides. I can't even untangle it.
Day two of the barbecue revolt is in the books, folks. And you probably heard Mayor John Tory said that he hoped that the police would throw the book at Adam Skelly here at Adamson's Barbecue. Well, they've done that. Not just the police, obviously the health department, the different agencies. 8 tickets in total to the entrepreneur that has been told that he has to shut down right away.
What I'm hoping to do here, because I don't believe my restaurant will make it through a winter of lockdowns.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of other businesses that won't make it through another winter of lockdowns. I'm hoping that by doing this, I'm standing up for the little guy, giving some other people some courage to do the same.
Can you set the table for the listener on what's going on? Like, what lockdown? What are they not supposed to be doing, and why are they doing it?
Okay, so in the summer, we reached, I would say, a reasonable equilibrium in terms of the COVID-19 situation in Toronto and in Ontario. The case numbers had dropped considerably. The initial sort of period of, like, everyone stay home, everyone sort of, to a certain extent, everyone sort of believed the messaging, and numbers came down, and we started to understand, like, okay, if we wear masks and we don't stay indoors, and, you know, we can make this work. And, you know, there were some weird, you know, there were some high profile, to a certain extent, stories in the summer when the weather was nice, sort of shaming people for gathering in public parks, for example, even though they were maybe doing it responsibly. But it felt like, to a certain extent, we were sort of getting a handle on that part of it. The challenge, of course, is, as we knew was going to happen, is schools were eventually going to have to open, which was a challenge, and the weather was eventually going to get colder, which made all of sort of their outdoor living much more challenging. And then on top of that, the economic sort of the trickling out of economic benefits like the CERB payments, you know, the monthly or the biweekly stipends, and the talk of mortgage and rent relief, the applications that were being given to tenants. Like it felt like there was a mechanism in place that was designed to help encourage people to stay home, that restaurants, let's say, and bars could stay closed and the employees could have some income to stay home and we could sort of minimize the spread of the virus. However, because we live in a province that's now under conservative rule, ultimately that sort of messaging eventually turned to, oh, we're going to start gradually opening up. There's all this discussion of stage one and stage two and or phase two or whatever you want to call it. And obviously that led to a situation where we right before schools were, you know, really needed to open in September, in the, you know, the bars and restaurants started opening up, case numbers started increasing, and it started to send us into another sort of lockdown, which is what has just occurred over the last little period of time. And that set us up to where we are now, where people are going, another lockdown, can't believe it. And there's a bit of a fight here because obviously the rules are being haphazardly applied. You know, employees are sort of hung out to dry. Rent and mortgages are a problem for people. We have, you know, eviction crisis, which we can get into later. And all of this sets the stage for this very unfortunate and bizarre news story where one restaurateur decides he's going to break the lockdown and become, you know, the stand against the government tyranny, so to speak, and open his restaurant against the mandates of the province. So that's where we sort of get to the start of this crisis.
Yeah, it's a media circus, but it's one thing that the guy is running this barbecue place in defiance of what I guess he figures are, you know, outrageous measures and an overreaction. But the people that support him, and he's not necessarily chasing these people away, represent some very dark forces in the city, which are the people that don't take the virus seriously, mm-hmm. people who don't believe that there is a virus going on, people who think that there's some evil master plan that's going on and the virus is a cover for it.
Mm-hmm.
People who are very upset that everything's closed, but are also upset at the idea of a vaccine, you know, and to make matters even worse, opportunistic groups like the neo-Nazis are showing up because whatever everybody's upset about, they want to get in on the media attention.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of came to a head last week when the lockdown officially took place and this guy announced that he was not going to do it and opened up his restaurant and out in Etobicoke and basically dared the cops to do anything about it. And there was this initial period where it looked like they weren't going to do anything about it. The premier refused to criticize him. The police refused to lay charges and the city got very upset.
And I think, yeah, exactly. They got upset and we got upset. And I think, you know, what's frustrating about it, again, is the complaints. You mentioned all these different complaints. Some of them are illegitimate, like the idea of like not wanting to, not believing in vaccines, for example. But the sort of fear people feel, that the average person feels, or the desperation they maybe feel that's growing now because of, you know, precarious employment, or because, you know, they have a relative that's, you know, they can't visit, or, you know, these sorts of things. What's unfortunate is there is a legitimate reason to be, let's say, angry and mistrustful of the government, particularly this government, this conservative government with Doug Ford at the head. And I think it's very sad to sort of see this energy being channeled this way. And that's why I sort of spoke about, like, the weird schism in right-wing sort of media, where you can write a column one day saying, well, you know, maybe the pandemic is a hoax, or maybe it's not as bad as they say, and we need to stand up for freedom and liberty. But then on the other side, you're saying, oh, but, you know, Doug Ford, the premier, the province, they're doing okay, they're doing it right. You know, all these guys complaining and saying this is a problem, it's like they got to just, you know, go along with what's going on. So there's this weird sort of thing where you're pro cop, but you're like, you're sort of trying to be an outlaw. Like I you're trying to support both sides.
The Toronto Sun, they wrote an editorial that was unsigned a few days ago where they said, you know, there's nothing wrong with questioning bad laws and to stand up against tyranny or whatever. And if you think that it's wrong to even question it, then you are the real authoritarian.
And what's very, very frustrating about that line of thinking is we are now talking about a barbecue business owner who is wealthy. Like, he is a wealthy man. He owns multiple, like, restaurants or establishments in the city of Toronto. He comes from wealth. Meanwhile, the people that are actually getting crushed by sort of tyranny are the people that were, you know, at protests for various causes over the summer, that have been standing up, you know, calling out to abolish or defund the police, Black Lives Matter. They've been, you know, they've been standing up for trans rights. They've been, now lately it's been COVID evictions happening like right now in the winter. It's people standing up for the encampments, the people in encampments in our public parks. Like if you ever wanted to understand like where government tyranny is coming from, you can watch like what the police and what is happening to like homeless people in the city's public parks right now, who are constantly in danger, basically, because of the forces of law and order. And no one in the right-wing media is ever going to say, we know those people, they need care, they need to be taken care of, and they should stand up against, you know, the boot that crushes them. They're, of course, the only thing the right-wing media are going to say about them is, get them out of there. They're dangerous. Get them out of there. We don't want to see them. And it's very gross that they glom on to this guy, this revolution, the anti-mask, the anti-maskers, the anti-vaskers, vaccine people, though, that movement. And it's very frustrating to see the two of them getting conflated at a time like this.
What I detect, I'm such a cynic when I see all this stuff. When I see the sort of barbecue revolution sloganeering being dredged up by the Toronto Sun, what I think is that a lot of the time, the right, they use the language and the imagery from the left and their protest movements to their own advantage. Like, they're making fun of movements like Black Lives Matter by having their own sort of bourgeoisie revolution where they pretend that they're, you know, supporting small business. But it just so happens that the business that they're supporting is a wealthy person who sells, you know, $17 sausages and has stoked up legitimate anger that's out there for their own advantage. It's like that they're making fun of actual protest movements and their aims by appropriating their language for some solipsistic display of their own discomfort.
And in this case, you mentioned there, the barbecue guy made tons of money off of this. Like, he got a fundraiser out of it and raised all this money for him. And you're right. It's a co-opting, not of messaging, but of means, of methods. And it's very frustrating that, like, if you were not necessarily plugged into either story, what you would see is the same thing. You would see a group of people. Fortunately, I can say from experience, because I've walked in and sort of accidentally walked, you know, not in, but adjacent to one of these anti-mask protests, you know, walking on Bloor Street and sort of going, what the heck's going on here? The numbers of the legitimate protests are much larger, but the photos, to a certain extent, look the same. It's people, signs, masks, and it's like, you know, signs and banners and sort of chanting and music, let's say. And so to standing outside of it, it's like, well, this is a protest. It's the same thing. You're getting to march down the street, and, you know, the cops stand by you and watch you do it, and etc. But it's exactly that. It's co-opting the messaging and the methods to delegitimize a very legitimate and very needed social movement. Whereas, you know, these guys, the anti-mask people and the barbecue
people,
they're
just having fun.
Yeah, it's like a laugh, and it's insane, because who they're confronting, or who they're, to a certain extent, who they're trying to you know, anger, are the same forces that are like aligned with them. Like, the cops that are there, I mean, the cops are bad people. Like, they're not, and I, you know, like, they're not. It's I don't know how it's even possible. I can't even put it into words, because I don't know how it's possible you can sort of be pro cop, ready. Like, if someone, you know, you can write a column saying defunding the police is ridiculous, but then be like, well, we have to question laws and we have to stand up, you know, for the little guy who, oh, by the way, happens to be, you know, very wealthy and own a bunch of small businesses. Like, it makes no sense.
But I would also put forward the argument, and I'm pretty sure I'm correct about this, that if a guy who was running a roti shop, a Jamaican guy, decided that he was not going to abide by these rules and he was going to keep his restaurant open and he was going to have the press there, he would have been arrested that day?
Well, this sort of thing did sort of happen. There was a celebration there was some sort of street demonstration up in the Eglinton, Allen, like Little Jamaica area. Mm-hmm. And it ended in like, you know, someone got up on the hood of a car, just kind of pumping their fists, like celebrating. And like the footage out of that was cops for miles, people getting, you know, held down to the ground. Like, it's amazing. Like, when you juxtapose that image with, again, the cops at this barbecue thing where it was kind of like they're there. There's kind of like, well, do we do anything? Are we supposed to, you know, the lock, they changed the locks on the front door, but then he walked in the back door. Like, it's like they're comically inept. But then if anything is going on with like black protesters or legitimate, you know, a legitimate confrontation with power, then all of a sudden these guys snap into, you know, Delta Force and they're ready to go, ready to tangle with anyone.
Well, this is what I mean about the sort of the decadence of this barbecue revolution is that they're doing it in a sort of cosplay level. Like the cops are they're the same people as the cops. They love the cops and they love law and order and they love, you know, they love law and order as long as the law and order is on their side and not your side. But they know that they're not going to get like beaten up like the cops could conceivably beat up people at a protest. At a real protest. It's a joke. It's sending a big FU to actual protest movements that, you know, we can play your game like they think it's a game.
And that's the part that's absolutely infuriating, the idea that it's seen as a game and that it's again, it's sort of overpowering. Like, I mean, part of this conversation, even the one we're having right now, it's like we're talking about this and it took up so much media space. It's very frustrating because there are legitimate reasons right now, especially even if the pandemic wasn't going on. It's like there are legitimate reasons to be very dissatisfied with the way the city's being run, the way the province is being run, the people that are being sort of ground up under the wheel of progress, or sorry, not progress, under the wheel of capitalism, and like the frustration that people feel now under COVID. Like, they're not wrong to point out that small businesses are closed, but the rules don't apply to Walmart or any other big box store. Like, that's a good point. Like, that, you know, that basically all of those operations, I mean, whether, you know, a grocery store obviously is an essential service, but they're all allowed to operate and no one's questioning that a Loblaws should be open. But there's a disconnect there where no one thinks about how small business people, the employees in these places, and the average person that is struggling to find employment, housing, you know, and care, how they're going to be taken care of. So the fact that, again, these guys are having a laugh, you know, oh, look, we're going to be in the news and you know, and Joe Warmington is going to high five us. The fact that that is the narrative and that is the sort of game that's being played is very, very infuriating, because there really is like a huge call for like revolution, essentially. And it's like just not being heard.
There are semiotics that are going on here too. One of the reasons why this whole powder keg is all centered around a barbecue place is because of meat. Because the right eat meat. And the lefties are all soy boys and vegetarians. And the reason why they want the barbecue place to close is because it's right wing and the pandemic is the excuse. Like, the reason why the red meat is such a big sort of thing for the right is because they want to contrast their opponents as, you know, weak. And I think that that's one of the reasons why this has been such a big story in Toronto. It's like a sort of an alt-right way of reinforcing this dynamic and making it seem like it's the left that want to close down the businesses. It's the right that wants freedom. Meanwhile, there's a pandemic going on.
I mean, I don't even know how to address that, because you're not wrong. That's what's absurd about it. Like, there is an idea there. There is definitely an image of in the right wing sort of imagination of you know, the guys who are just eating meat, the Jordan Peterson meat diet, and the idea of sort of that's the macho goal. And it's just like, but you know, just it's just a total narrowing of the world. Like, it's just a total misunderstanding of everything. Like, it's just I just have to just you try not to be exasperated, because I think, again, like you can dismiss all of this, but and I think some of these people are particularly contemptible, particularly some of the right wing mouthpieces that are giving sort of voice to all this, and some of the wealthier people that are capitalizing on all the sort of confusion or mistrust. But there are a lot of people that are sort of swept up by it, and it's the same people that are that have been swept up by sort of the Fords in Toronto and in Ontario, and it's just the lack of imagination about, you know, it's something as goofy as meat, or just sort of like in the broader sense, just a total disconnect between the world as it is, the world as it can be, and sort of the actual push that could happen, you know, to make it better for everyone, and just the breakdown there that just is very disheartening.
But in a very dangerous way, like the fact that sort of QAnon stuff is getting dragged into this and being given a platform in Toronto's media market. Like all these groups that want more attention in the media than they're getting are glomming themselves on to this story. And for in a lot of the situations, they're compatible. Like you could see a QAnon guy wanting, you know,
yeah,
nobody to wear a mask and for all the stores to be open because it's a hoax.
And again, it speaks to like on a base level, like again, there are people capitalizing on this for their own ends because they're, you know, we joked about cult being a cult leader, but it's like they want to take on this leadership role and get all the power and prestige that comes with that. But on a base level, it is sort of this idea of like a susceptibility to this line of thinking where the people have been painted into a corner. And so their understanding of like how society is supposed to work, who is supposed to get what. And, you know, if someone is getting something they don't deserve, well, that means I'm not getting it. Therefore I have to keep it from them or take it from them. And then this kind of protectionist mindset. I mean, these things are all intertwined. Now I start to sound like a conspiracy guy myself, but it's fascinating to watch like how the city works in terms of like housing, for example, where I keep bringing up the eviction crisis because there's this understanding that like the people that are saying, well, the pandemic is a hoax. So it's like, so everyone could just go back to normal. But it's like, but there are people that whose jobs and their homes, like they're on a precipice here, and it very much is a real threat, and they very much need support. And there's a solution here where we talk about larger economic sort of stimulus to help people on the very low end of society, and it's just not a thing that enters in their minds. It as you said, it becomes more about QAnon and this cult like thinking of, oh no, it's all a hoax and it's wishful thinking and we got to pretend none of this stuff exists. But all that energy is being totally misdirected.
Those kind of paranoid conspiracy theories have more currency when we're living in a crisis.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, they don't understand why this is happening. And so if somebody provides them with a quick answer, it sounds good.
And it's depressing that, you know, it's this BBQ, this barbecue owner, or it's the anti-mask ringleader, the failed son of those, of some.
Oh, that's Chris Sky, right?
It's Chris Sky,
right? Not mask Sky.
Yeah. So Chris Sky, so he's, you know, he's a classic, like, guy from like the GTA, from like Vaughn, you know, wears a tank top all the time and is very proud of the fact that he wants to get out there in the streets and party and talk about liberty. But again, these people are disconnected from everyday reality. Like, and I don't just mean that in a sort of metaphorical sense, like in terms of an understanding of how the world works. I mean, like they literally do not know how people are sort of like being under threat from COVID and from precarious employment and from precarious housing. Like none of that enters into their mind. So of course the tack they take is the most selfish one. Oh, well, obviously this is all a hoax and don't wear a mask because I don't need to wear a mask and you don't have to wear a mask. And none of this affects them in their everyday life because they come from wealth. Like that's the bottom line.
One thing that I've thought about with the attention that the, you know, Adamson's barbecue guy has been getting, this sort of positive attention, even as we find out more and more bad stuff. Like he's a small business owner, but he doesn't actually have a business license and things like that, you know, like that blows holes in his credibility. But one thing I think about a lot these days is that the media doesn't really have a defense mechanism or a way of coping and covering narcissists, which is what one of the big lessons that we can now learn a little bit more now that Trump is going away, except he's not going away. He's just not going to be the president of the United States anymore. But all the stuff that he represents and his own ego are going to be in the news for a long time. The media hasn't quite figured out how to cover narcissists because you wind up just giving them airtime. And they are good television, I suppose, or they're good, they sell newspapers. But this Chris Sky guy and the Barbecue Anon guy and Trump, I mean, they're classic narcissists. Some are more successful than others. But they want attention, and they get attention.
So I think what's frustrating about that is I feel like the only real solution, like, I mean, obviously, like, media is going to chase stories and you know, they're going to go after, like, you're right, they don't necessarily have a mechanism to deal with narcissism. What's frustrating is that the other things that we've been talking about here, the other actual sort of, troubling things that are happening right now or desperate things that are happening right now, they are not necessarily getting the amount of airtime. Like, as people have been pointing out, there's a huge sort of blind spot right now in Toronto media in terms of the eviction crisis, where people are going to tenant boards and getting thrown out of their homes. Like, that's happening right now, and cops are showing up and throwing people, families out of their houses, out of their apartments, and that's like just business as usual. Like, no one even thinks about, well, I shouldn't say no one, people think about it, but the media is not necessarily saying, holy cow, this is a huge story, because the huge story is, look at these yahoos over here in a parking lot in Etobicoke, or look at this bro at Yonge and Dundas Square with these other morons. And like, to not report on that, I understand the sort of impulse or desire to sort of do that thing. It's the same impulse that you want to dunk on someone on Twitter. Like, I get why you sort of want to do that, but the underreported stories, discussing reality, like talking about what effect this pandemic is having on people, and not just small business owners, but like average people, employees, you know, people with disabilities, people with mental health issues, people with precarious housing, like, they're all out there, and like, that is just totally not part of the story, and it's very frustrating because it feeds narcissistic impulse that we end up with.
Yeah, I mean, you know, here we are doing an episode about the Barbecue Anon guy. I mean, we're part of the problem, Danny.
No, listen, I'm trying to give voice to some of these other matters, but I think that's the challenge, and it sort of, I mean, the common denominator here is it's the narcissists are people that have a lot. And so their connection to the problems of anyone else are just not a thing they have to think about. So as a result, the narrative that sort of comes out of these stories totally shifts away the people who are actually hurting, who are actually at risk. It just goes back to these boneheads.
The media also, the right-wing media, is always trying to have it both ways, right? Like the pro-cop newspaper being mad at the cops for enforcing the law. They're so mad. They're not mad at the cops for enforcing the bylaw evictions, but they are mad at the cops because they shut down the barbecue place.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think you're ever going to explain to someone like Joe Warmington from the Toronto Sun. I want to keep saying his name because he's such
Sprawler.
He's such a doofus. You're never going to explain to him the difference. And it's very frustrating because there's just no way to break through whatever fog they live in. I don't even know how you can even begin to have a conversation with Joe Warmington about anything.
Oh my God.
Maybe you could talk about Billy Ray Cyrus. Maybe that's the extent of it.
Yeah. I should mention here that, somebody mailed me an autographed copy of Joe Warmington's biography of Billy Ray Cyrus, a friend of mine. We're no longer friends. Kidding. We're probably better friends now. The other thing that I loved about the meltdown last week when the cops finally did shut down the barbecue place was when they all went over to Doug Ford's house, the protesters. These are the people that voted for him in the first place. The Toronto Sun is the newspaper that wanted Doug Ford to be the premier. And he's doing a terrible job. And they're mad at him for not doing a worse job?
There's levels to the frustration with this story, because I'm actually of the opinion, and this is going to be maybe the hottest take of the hour, I'm actually of the opinion that protesting, like every so often there's a protest at like John Tory's condo, he's the mayor of Toronto, or at Doug Ford's house somewhere in Etobicoke, And there's always somebody that says, this is out of line. This kind of protest is scary. You know, don't do this with people's families.
There's an unwritten rule. Never, ever go after their families.
I am of the opinion that these protests actually should happen at this guy's condo or this guy's house, because I feel like, of course, the only way to really make them feel uncomfortable with their decisions and policy aims is by really confronting them with what they're doing. What's sad about this is, to a certain extent, these right-wing weirdos have, like, you know, beaten us to the punch. They have shown up at Doug Ford's house to protest whatever it is they think they're protesting. And, like, the optics of that are, like, the idea of that in theory is good. What they're protesting makes no sense and is ridiculous. That's what I would say.
And also, like, 99 out of 100 people at this protest are going to vote for him again.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, they're mad at him right now.
Yeah.
But they're not mad at him because of the bad job that he's doing in general, managing this crisis. They're mad at him because he's not owning the libs. Like, they expect him to be the guy who says, the barbecue place is open, here's the official order, folks. And he has, you know, I guess what they consider capitulated. They're probably going to get even more angry at him when he starts talking about getting the vaccine. All the QAnon supporters are going to feel that he betrayed them.
I think this is a fascinating, the arc of Doug Ford on this and this thing has been, it's been pretty wild, because I think at the beginning he was saying all kinds of really stupid things, very very cavalier things. Then I think somewhere along the line people told him, his medical people or his, you know, senior staff, whoever he's listening to, they said, actually this is serious and you better, you know, shut up and say the right thing. And then he did take it serious, and then of course we got all these people going, oh, Doug Ford, maybe he's not so bad, maybe he's doing an okay job. It's like, no, he is doing the exact bare minimum to get us through the first sort of few months of this, and then at the first whisper of going back to normal, he took it. He did not figure out a way to manage this thing in any way. And now the crises in the schools and long-term healthcare centers, in, you know, in businesses, everything else, it's a fiasco. And again, that trickles down to the city government in terms of their approach to things, the funding they're supposed to have. And again, we're talking about, you know, just the wing nuts on the side who, this is all just theater to them. It's all a game.
Yeah. But I mean, I think a lot of people think of all of this stuff as being one giant game. Like it, to me, there are a lot of people with nothing going on. And like, this is a way of sort of providing some kind of meaning. Mm-hmm. And it's theater. And they're so mad that other people are living these sort of intense lives. And they want their life to be more intense. And they see the energy of protest movements to affect change. And they decide that they can do it too. Except they want to have a protest movement to maintain the status quo. And that's the big difference to me. But the really, really strident sort of anti-lockdown, anti-mask movements, I always think that what they're doing is they're being accelerationists. Like, they want society to collapse and unravel, because in the comic book that they live in, and they would then rise to control Gotham City or whatever.
Well, I mean, this is a whole other thing. And I think when you were talking about some of the shadier neo-Nazi forces that are involved, I mean, I think there are levels to this. And I think that's sort of the grim sort of reality here, where, yes, there are some goofy cosplayers who are just getting in here to have some fun and be part of a group, you know, and feel like they belong to something. And you're right. I think there is a mindset there that sort of speaks to the idea that they would get to be the comic book, you know, excel in this
whatever
future.
They'd be the Joker or whatever.
Yeah, right. But I think the grim reality is, and I think there's, you know, there are, I don't want to overstate this, I don't have all the facts here, but there are, you know, some scary right-wing movements in Canada. And I think there is a force there that would love to recruit from that and would love to see where it goes. And I think it's very grim. Like,
if you want people to get on your side with your movement and to take your side, then to me, one of the first tests that you should be able to ace is when the Nazi comes by to say what a great job you're doing. You should tell him to get the fuck off my property. But instead, he's like, oh, thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks. Really appreciate your support. You know, and it's like, well, I'm never, ever going to eat there again.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that is basically the basic test. And I think this is where...
By the way, I've never been there. I just want to make that. I want to get that on the record. I was never there. Friends of mine were like, actually, they were. I like their barbecue. Or I've been there a few times. I'm never going again.
I have not been there. And I can honestly say that too. And now I'll never go either. I mean, it's a small gesture, like a sort of the idea. I mean, you're seeing this a lot now where people are saying, let's buy local and let's support local business. It's a positive idea. I think obviously some businesses are adjusting to it better than others. And I think people are responding to the idea that they have a hand in their community. But I think that sort of messaging is one level. The idea that you have a hand in your community in terms of supporting local businesses and being participating in that local sort of neighborhood, economy, and sense of, you know, belonging. But now what we have to do is figure out ways to expand the sphere of that, to understand that like everyone that's in your community is part of that community. And that's the people that are struggling, and that's other people, let's say, who are not struggling, and understanding how, you know, everyone can help each other. And I think that's the missing piece here. And it's very frustrating again that like just the general sense of misunderstanding about what protest movements are for and how they enact change and why they're doing what they're doing. And it's frustrating to see that we sort of keep circling back to these wing nuts.
It's also very frustrating for me, you know, because I've been trying to be a good boy during all this. Like I've been washing my hands a lot, yeah. And I go to the grocery store and back. I go for walks, but I certainly don't go, into crowds, and I keep my subway rides to a minimum. I'm doing my best to lay low and to assume that if we all keep being careful, we're going to be okay. So it's very frustrating to watch this strange phenomenon of watching people who are angry about the right things, but they're taking it out on the wrong targets. Mm-hmm. It just feels so dysfunctional.
Mm-hmm. I think that dysfunction is very infuriating, because it did feel like there was a window there where we did sort of get a handle on things, and we could have sort of said, okay, here's how we're going to do this until there's a vaccine. And instead we sort of just went away from that. And now it definitely feels, to bring this back to Invasion of the Body Snatchers and what I was saying before, it definitely feels like now there is this kind of like, well, why fight it? Like, we can't get a handle on it. We tried the thing where we stayed home for a few weeks. Why are we bothering to do any of this? Why don't we just, you know, whatever. If people get it, they get it. They get sick. It's a fascinating and frustrating myopic view about like, you know, how, like what could happen? Like this idea, like, you know, you see this all the time. People are saying like, well, I'm healthy, so I mean, I'll be okay if I get it. And it's like, yeah, you might be. We don't know the long-term effects yet. There's some pretty disturbing stories about that. But we also don't know who you're going to give it to in terms of other people, older people, people who are more at risk. And it's very frustrating, even in the discussion of like the death toll, where people are like, well, this is in line with any other year based on, you know, like car crashes kill more people. And you're like, but car crashes are not contagious. Like you can't
catch a car crash. Yeah. I mean, you can get hit by a car, yeah. But you can't spread a car crash.
Right. So like, I think that sort of thinking where it's like you're like, again, I understand people's frustration. I understand people's desperation. But like the turn towards sort of like just essentially giving up or sort of saying, well, whatever.
Whatever. I'm just going to go have a barbecue sandwich.
Yeah.
Some things will be with us from now on. Like, I'm sure that when you go to the grocery store from now on, it's going to be plexiglass at the cash and stuff like that. You know, I'm a little nostalgic for last year.
Yeah.
But I do like the improvements to being a bicyclist in Toronto, which wouldn't have happened without the pandemic.
I think that it was amazing to see how quickly the city, like, again, it's like we were speaking about before. These problems that seem to be so large can be solved. So a situation where like bike lanes are really challenging to install on various public roads. And then, yeah, they use the pandemic as a pretense, but every bike lane they installed should have been installed like 5 to 10 years ago. You know, putting bike lanes, yeah, on university, extending bike lanes on Bloor and Danforth. I mean, these are no-brainer decisions that, like, you know, the city has sort of, like, city staff sort of know what they're doing. People in transportation know what they're doing. But then when it hits the political sort of gridlock, it's like, well, you know, we got, you know, what about this? What about that? What about the drivers? And so it becomes a problem. And it's like, well, it's great that, you know, we took advantage of that, let's say, to sort of speed up some of the things that we should have been doing a long time ago.
I assume that now that it's here, it will stay. Like, even if we start to get out of the pandemic mindset, that we're not going to lose our bike lanes. I think people realize that they're fine.
I mean, I think that we will. I think, fortunately, in the areas that they've been installed downtown, the councilors there understand the benefits. We're not going back to the days. I got to mention a Ford again with Rob Ford, where bike lanes were like seen as like, it was like a great win to take out a bike lane and be like, yeah, they're, the roads are car for cars again. It's like we've moved away from that. And I think it's still a bit of a struggle to talk about like road safety in general in Toronto and trying to push for those things. We're making small gains, but it feels like for every step forward, we take a few steps back. And I could talk another hour about that issue, but I think people are starting to appreciate public space, which is nice. I mean, the patio idea, I mean, sometimes people go a little too far with it in terms of the shelters, the structures they're building on the sidewalk. But the idea that basically we opened up sidewalks and thought about how we could reclaim public space away from cars, I feel like people saw that and said, oh, like we can do that. That can be a permanent function. We don't need all this parking. We don't need these extra lanes. We don't need, like, people still want to congregate at businesses. People still want to go and walk on city streets. And what's crazy is they wanted to do that even during a pandemic.
Yeah, it's a very interesting time to be working at the city.
I mean, yeah, it is. I think it's always a bit of a challenge. But I think, the way I look at it is I don't want to make this sound too grim, but I take the Akiru, like that approach of like, to a certain extent, it's unsung work. You're trying to gain little things here and there that you know will help in little pockets of the city. And like, I joke that whenever there's like a new curb bump out or like, a traffic signal, like I had a hand in some of this stuff, and it's kind of cool to be like, yeah, there it is. Like, that's it. And it might only change, people's sense about an intersection a very small degree, but it's kind of like, yeah, that happened. All right, cool. Like, and that's satisfying, even if you don't get to sign your name to it or something. You know what I mean? But if you see a new traffic signal coming in on DuPont in the next 5 years, I started the motion to get that happening. So I'm very proud about that. Well, so we'll see when it finally gets installed.
Oh, that'll be great. Yeah. I'm looking forward to what DuPont looks like in 10 years.
Yeah, we'll see.
Some of the drawings make it look like Naboo or something. It's like this rolling hills and big white, sci-fi towers. It's like, I'll believe it when I see it, because it's the Galleria to me still.
The Galleria is a perfect example, actually, at Dufferin and DuPont. I mean, there are going to be new public roads on there and new signals. So you're going to have a whole block, there's a huge block of land there that is like, for the most part, looked like just a parking lot. You wouldn't even know that there was like a community center there, a very nice community center to a certain extent in terms of the facilities, pool and the gym. And you wouldn't know that there was like a park space back in there. And now it's like, we're going to try and figure out ways to open that up. And yes, I mean, there's going to be new condos there. People get up in arms about condos, but there's a lot of infrastructure that comes along with that that benefits a lot of other people in the long run. So here's hoping that it comes to plan,
Can I make a suggestion for when you name the streets in the Galleria, in the old Galleria area?
Okay.
Can I make a special request?
Okay.
There was a store in the Galleria called Smoker's Choice.
Oh, yeah.
It was like the cheap convenience store, but it was called Smoker's Choice. And they had window displays of like Lotto 649 and stuff. So can you name one of the streets in the new area Smoker's Choice Lane or something like that? Smoker's Choice Boulevard?
I wish it was that easy. There's a whole like separate group of people in the city that manage the street names. But if I ever find out how I can play a part, I'll try and see if I can put it in there. I'll throw
when
the name
we go off air, give me their phone numbers and I'll tell them that Daniel said that I could talk to you about this.
Yeah.
Has there been anything that you've seen or read lately that's really given you a shot in the arm?
There's two shows. One that just happened, How to with John Wilson, and one that was sort of more 2018, 2019, pre-pandemic, called Joe Pera Talks With You. And I found both of those shows, for different reasons, really spoke to a lot of the things we were talking about. And I think How to with John Wilson, I think really, I mean, it really speaks to all of the things we're talking about: living in a community, sharing space, finding how capitalism is sort of forcing different market solutions on people that are unsatisfactory, and how you can people still find ways to be themselves and express themselves, even if it's kind of weird or strange. Like, it speaks to all of these different urban issues, but also it speaks to all these human desires, like the idea of, you know, just trying to get along with people and exist with people. And obviously, it's more of a documentary style show, whereas Joe Parra Talks With You is very much a mannered, little sort of goofy ish type of thing. And the episodes are about 11 minutes long. But what was really striking about that show is same idea. It comes on in a very sort of very sweet and earnest way, and then right when you think it is going to sort of laugh at how earnest it's being, it actually just sort of embraces the sweetness of these things, whether they be just, you know, sharing a cup of coffee with your neighbor, or sort of the quiet contemplation of, you know, nature, or like it's a very soothing show. And Joe Parra, his persona is like this kind of grandfatherly guy, even though he's like 30 years old, but it's very much an embracing of like stillness and small community, and like really marveling at like everything that humans have achieved, and how we keep striving to be, you know, wondrous and beautiful. And, you know, it sort of steers away from ugliness, but it's capturing all the goodness that is inherent to people. And I think there's something about that was really speaking to me, obviously, because I've been going on about it. But I think it just spoke to me in these times where, you know, you're sort of sitting there, you're sitting in your condo, or if you're lucky, you're sitting in your space, and you're in relative comfort, but you're constantly sort of thinking about, well, how do we get out of this, and what's going to change? And, you know, I think those shows kind of imbued this idea that no matter what happens, and no matter what political forces or capitalist forces sort of act on us, the human spirit, or the way people try to connect and relate and exist together will continue on. We'll push back against that no matter what happens. So I think it really, it's been speaking to me. That's what I have to say. That's what I'll say about that.
I haven't seen either show, and I'm dying to see them. I've heard nothing but good things about them. I just haven't watched them yet, but I will. You have encouraged me to take the next step.
Yeah. I think on Twitter now, John Wilson's show has become like the show du jour. And oftentimes I don't get swept up in that sort of thinking, because I feel like oftentimes there is like this like 2 week period where like the other show is The Queen's Gambit. Everyone was talking about The Queen's Gambit. And so I watched it, and I actually made it through to the end. But the whole time I was like, yeah, all right. Yeah. It's like, all right. Yeah. It's all not bad. Like, it's watchable. You put it on, you eat dinner, that sort of thing. But it's not a transformative, for me, it wasn't a transformative experience. Whereas I felt like John Wilson found something that really got to something new that I hadn't seen before on TV. And I feel like that was very valuable. So yes, the highest recommendation I could give for that one in particular.
Well, I think we're going to have to leave it here, Daniel. This is a very, very fun conversation. Where can people find you on Twitter?
So I am at @aka_Reynolds. My name is spelled like the character from Phantom Thread. You can find all my various projects and things and thoughts. Like I said, like you said at the top, I'm an online person, so everything's there pretty much.
Yes. And thank you for coming on strong and really wanting to come on here and talk about it. I admired your moxie.
Sometimes you just got to invite yourself. That's basically, you know, that's what I do sometimes.
Yeah, yeah, I appreciated it. Maybe it wasn't a fun conversation because we were talking about alien invaders and people wanting a disease to spread and stuff, but I had about as much fun as one can have talking about this with you.
Same here. I'm always pumped up to talk about this stuff, even the grim stuff.
Well, would you come on the show again, Daniel Reynolds?
I would. Yes, I would.
All right. Well, we'll have to talk about that later. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're going to have to leave it here. We'll have another episode of Junk Filter in the next few days. If you're enjoying the show, please tell your friends. Please like and subscribe to it wherever you get your favorite podcasts. If you're really enjoying the show and you'd like to support it directly and have access to bonus episodes, sign up for our Patreon. And the link to that is at our Twitter account, which is Junk Filter Pod. The original music for this program is by Marker Starling. My name is Jesse Hawken. Thank you for listening. Spriggs. When I'm dealing with Mr. Spriggs, I only deal with the best. Gotta have that Spriggs. Call 733-8578. Mr. Spriggs Barbecue. It's always Mr. Spriggs Barbecue. Tender. Mr. Spriggs Barbecue. Meat falls off the bone. Mr. Spriggs Barbecue. Spriggs Barbecue. Mr. Spriggs Barbecue. It's always Mr. Spriggs Barbecue. Tender. Mr. Spriggs Barbecue. Meat falls off the bone. Mr. Spriggs Barbecue. Mr. Spriggs Barbecue. Oklahoma's best barbecue. Mr. Spriggs. Located at 1017 South Air Depot. Or call 733-8578.